So this is class three on Britain since 1945, and we'd got up to the 1950s of the Conservative government. So Churchill coming back into government in 1951 and recognising that many aspects of the welfare state were here to stay, and he was not to attack them too hard. And secondly, by now it was clear that there was a real economic boom, and so raising a lot of money for the welfare state from taxes was not too difficult, because I mentioned last week when the economy is going well and companies are making profit quite easily, they're not so worried about paying a bit more tax. And that's a very important point. So, how can we say about that? Well, so Churchill, in fact, surrounded himself in 1951 with a lot of younger conservatives who were, in many ways, what we call One Nation Tories. Now, what is a One Nation Tory? It's a journalistic term. Yeah, journalism is getting more important, so journalistic terms are important. It's a person from the Conservative Party, but who tends towards the idea that we're a one nation altogether, so we need to respect the trade unions, accept sections of the welfare states, but also, obviously, be very interested in the fortunes of private enterprise. But it's kind of the left wing of the Conservative Party. That doesn't make them very left-wing, but just more. So, for example, a one-nation Tory will not be saying the trade unions are our enemies and we must defeat them. That's another kind of Tory. Yeah? It would be more about cooperation and so on. One nation, yeah, we're all in it together. And so Churchill was working with a team of people, younger people coming into the education. The economy is booming, austerity retreating, school now obligatory from the age of 5 to the age of 15. The Conservatives did think at one point of reducing this and saying 6 till 14 is enough, but this was not possible. Lots of houses built. I mentioned some of this last week. There was also rent control. That is to say that the landlords, the people who owned the houses, were not allowed to charge any rent they wished. The law intervened and said this is the maximum you can charge for a two-bedroom flat, etc. So this is also part of the welfare state, yeah? The welfare state, we immediately think of hospitals, unemployment benefits, and education. But the welfare state is a much, very, much, much wider thing, which includes things like this, yeah? A maximum rent. And you have, the laws are different in different countries, but in France, for example, there is a law about maximum rents. It's, in my opinion, relatively generous to landlords. But if you're a landlord and you rent a flat, it must be linked to the average rent in that part of town. Yeah, something like that. So that's part of the welfare state. And in Britain at this time, it was more strict. There were maximum rents going on. And so health. Let's have a look at industry then, a little bit of industry in this time in the 1950s. Well, one of the things which is very important here is that when you have a situation where unemployment is very low, this gives a lot of confidence to workers. Say, well, we want more wages. And the boss says, of course, if you want more wages, you can go somewhere else. And the workers say, okay. Yeah, completely different situation. When unemployment is very high, then the boss says, if you want more wages, you can go somewhere else. And the worker says, oh, sorry, I didn't say anything. I apologize. Yeah? So completely different situation. And we have, in this period, in the 50s and 60s, what we sometimes call do-it-yourself reformism. This, again, is a journalistic term. Yeah, this is I put it in inverted commas. It's not an official term. And what does this mean? It means that when the ordinary people want a better life, a bit more money, you know, money is important, then they don't look to the government. I wonder what the government can do for me. That's not necessary. They just simply look to the trade unions and workplace organisations and say, hey, let's tell the boss we need more money, because the trade unions are very powerful in the workplace, in the local workplace. And in some cases, some of the new industries, the level of power was very high indeed. For example, in the car factories, where people were, or in the engineering factories, people men mostly working on machines, and the tradition they had was they took a piece of chalk, 1, 2, 3, and they drew a line, and if the foreman, le contremaître, if the foreman crosses that line, we're all on strike. And this is possible when there's no unemployment. And the foreman says, okay. There's another famous story. It's not typical, but it's a sign. And that is, there was, in the Ford factory, very symbolic car factory, of course, car ownership is rising. In the Ford factory, there's a wonderful book called Working for Ford, which was written by Mr. Bainan, Hugh Bainan, I think. And it's just, what was life like? He worked in Ford, in the factory, in the 1950s. And it's a description. There's one wonderful thing. Was when it was hot in the summer, sometimes they didn't work and they went to play football instead. Yeah? And the boss didn't say anything because he knew that in general they would come back tomorrow. Yeah. And there's one case, they very often had short strikes. Very often. And we're not happy, we're on strike. And 1 hour later, the boss had said, okay, because that was the situation. There was one case where they stopped working and they went out and played football, and the foreman came, what do you want? You want a strike, what do you want? So, we want lime juice. Nous voulons du jus de citron vert. And the foreman went to, and of course, you understand, what they really wanted was just to annoy the foreman, you know, jus de citron vert. Yeah. And the foreman went to look for some. Yeah. He came back, I'm sorry, but we've only got orange juice. Yeah? This is just to give you an idea of what the atmosphere could be like at this time. Okay, 1952 to 1953. Big events. The king dies. And we have a new young queen, Elizabeth. Yeah? She's fine. The king died young. He was only 56. He was only young when he died, and they fired 56 cannons on the television. Sorry, they fired 56 cannons at the funeral. And this is often cited as the first big event on television. Television was just beginning to take off. It was a minority. Most people did not have a television. But by 1965, most people did. Yeah, so over the next 10 years, television rising, and you have many, many stories of this time. And say, oh yes, every Friday night I used to go to my friend's house, and 10 of us went to my friend's house because he had a television. Yeah, well, that was the kind of situation. I was not around yet. Other important big changes at this time, first of all in science, Mr. Crick and some of his friends discovered DNA. That was a British invention. L'ADN, bien sûr. En français, vous dites tout à l'envers. Okay, so the DNA. So obviously, this is a very important scientific discovery. What's interesting about this is that more and more big scientific discoveries are no longer made by individuals. It's big teams, and this is perhaps one of the last one where really was an individual, a couple of individuals. Francis Crick, his name was. the other thing which happened in 1953 was the first people to get to the top of Mount Everest. Again, this was seen as a symbol of empire superiority, because Edmund Hillary was—I think he was from New Zealand—but he was part. You know, he was represented, and he was supported by Britain. He represented Britain in the world, and people were very excited about it. Was a person from the British Empire who was the first. Now, of course, he wasn't alone. He was with a guy called Tenzing. This is important. Hillary and Tenzing. And Tenzing was a local man, a local expert. This is how you go up Everest, apparently, you get a local expert. But what is very interesting about this is that at the time, and even in the 1960s, they used to talk about, so well, first of all, they said Hillary conquered Everest. And then later on, they began to say Hillary and Tenzing. But nobody ever, they always said Edmund Hillary and Sherpa Tenzing. Sherpa is the name of the people. So he was not given a first name. Whereas today, when you talk about it, you get they both have a first name. And this is an evolution connected with racism. Yeah, that the idea was he's just a Sherpa. You know, Edmund Hillary is a hero, and Tenzing is just a Sherpa. Like an Indian, you know, an Indian, in inverted commas. So it's interesting to see. So that is, j'ai oublié son prénom, comme quoi j'ai encore les restes de mon éducation. Quand j'étais petit, on disait, oh, je ne suis pas Tenzing. Okay, so it begins with an N. Mr. N. Tenzing, there you go. Very interesting. And the other interesting thing is that if you look for the photographs, there is a photograph of Mr. Tenzing on the top of Everest. And there are no photographs of Edmund Hillary on the top of Everest. And we're not sure, but we think, or I think, that Edmund Hillary understood the racism situation. And he said, yeah, if there's a photograph of a white man on the top of Everest, this will be the only photograph in the entire world. And so he insisted on having the photograph, and the only photograph which is known is of the other guy. It's quite interesting, yes, because Edmund Hillary was very attached to the Sherpa people, and he worked very hard for other ways of intervening in their lives around that. So that was an interesting but anecdote there. So this is what is causing this is what is in the atmosphere in the 1950s. We got a new queen. We got to the top of Everest. The industry is booming. The trade unions are very, very powerful. This is the kind of atmosphere. People very, very optimistic. Again, it's easy to say, but I'm going to claim that it's true anyway. The other big debate which changes in the 1950s is the debate about capital punishment. Now, capital punishment is a debate around the world which has very much changed since the 1950s. Today, the largest number of executions in the world are in the United States and China. Those are the two winners, if you like, at the top there. And the situation in Britain, I'm going to explain a little bit. And I'm going to go back before the 1950s and after the 1950s to give the whole story of capital punishment. So there were, first of all, there were developments in the 19th century when public executions were stopped. Executions were now to be held in private and not in public. So that is an important change in itself. After 1931, they changed the law and they said that pregnant women would no longer be executed. Before that, if a person accused of found guilty of murder, for example, was pregnant, they would wait until she had the baby and then hang her the day afterwards. Okay, so that was stopped in 1931, although in fact it had not been done for some while, for some time. It was the last time had been in 1873. After 1933, a new law said you cannot be hanged if you were under 18 at the time of the crime. So a different situation for young people. And in 1946, the last execution for treason happened, pour la trahison. This was a person who intervened regularly on the German radio trying to persuade people that Hitler was wonderful. And he was hanged for, he was a British person, yeah? And he was hanged for treason in 1946. In 1955, so now we're in the 50s. In 1955, Ruth Ellis became the last woman, was the last woman to be executed. And when she was executed, they didn't know she was going to be the last, but she was, in fact, the last woman to be executed. And in 1956, then, there was a bill in Parliament to abolish the death penalty. Now, where did this come from? That's interesting. I shouldn't have asked that question because I'm not sure where it came from. Let's move on to something else. The death penalty bill in 1956 was voted by the House of Commons but refused by the House of Lords. I hope you remember that in Britain, if you want to pass a law, you have to, first of all, get the House of Commons on your side, and then the House of Lords, and then the Queen, although the Queen's signature is automatic. But it must go through the two houses, and it was refused by the House of Lords. In 1957, there was an act which reduced the number of offences which can lead to execution. So, for example, murder in general was no longer a cause for execution. The majority of murders are people murdering their wife or their husband because they're jealous. That's the, even today, that's the favourite reason for murdering people. So at this time they said that you could only be executed for murder of a police officer, murder trying to escape, murder by shooting, or murder in the course of a theft. And that was where the situation was. The reason a big debate came up was because of the case of Peter Bentley. And this is a rather amusing case. Peter Bentley was involved in a robbery, and his partner killed a police officer. Peter Bentley was arrested, and while he was arrested and standing there, his partner killed a police officer. The partner could not be executed because he was under 18. But in this kind of case, the whole team is considered to be guilty of the murder. You can't say, "Oh, I didn't do it; he did it. We were committed." It doesn't work. Don't do that. Okay. Peter Bentley was going to be executed, and the story that they gave is that Peter Bentley, they say, shouted to his partner, "Let him have it." His partner had a gun. And the police officer was there. This is the story. Now, this is very, 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 very strange because there are two possible meanings of "let him have it." Either go ahead and shoot him, or don't shoot him, give him the gun. Il y a des moments où il ne faut pas être ambigu. C'est vraiment non visité. And this is it's kind of amusing in a way because there's enormous debates about this. It's impossible to know today what the absolute truth is. Yeah, but it may also be that the police simply invented the idea that they'd heard him say, "Let him have it." It's a very unusual expression for a young person to use. Might be. We will never know. So this was the situation of the debate. And in fact, it will be 10 years later, 1965, that when capital punishment will be suspended for 5 years, and 1969, when capital punishment is finally abolished. Then 1969 is the abolition. So just to give you the rest of the story, we're still in the 1950s, but I wanted to mention that. So since 1969, no executions in Britain. Now, do you remember your French history? When was capital punishment abolished in France? Anybody got an idea? 1981. Under President Mitterrand, yeah, the arrival of Mitterrand. It was one of the big changes with the arrival of Mitterrand in 1981. I know you were very young at the time. Okay, right. My students get younger every year. It's terrible. 1955, then, we're moving into, we're going back to the 1950s. In 1955, Winston Churchill is very ill, and he retires in 1955. Through ill health, and Anthony Eden becomes Prime Minister. Now he was educated at Eton, yeah, from an elite school, Eton, the most prestigious school in Britain, and he was hoping to join the British Army and go to the Officers' College at Sandhurst, but he had bad eyes, and so they rejected him. And in the 1950, he was successful then in the 1955 elections. So they had elections again in 1955, and the Conservative majority rose to 58. That is to say that in the House of Commons, the Conservatives had 50% of the seats plus 58 seats. That's a good majority. Yeah. If you have a majority of only three seats, that's very bad, because if three people die, and members of parliament are very old, or three people are ill, or three people disagree, then you're in problems. So Conservatives had a comfortable majority. They won without any real problem in 1958. This caused a certain crisis in the Labour Party. The Labour Party was very proud of the welfare state, the National Health Service, 1945, and then they lost in 1951, and they lost again in 1950. You can lose once, and that doesn't cause a big crisis. The second time they lost, 1955, big crisis, and the Daily Mirror, which was a daily newspaper close to the Labour Party, had the front page, Attlee must go, for Viry Notchev. Attlee, the leader of the Labour Party and ex-Prime Minister. That's how it happens. Okay, this is the period then where the Cold War gets hotter or colder. Let's say the Cold War, in any case, gets more tense. There you go. This is in 1947, the American President Harry Truman had announced the Truman Doctrine, which is the division of the world into two spheres, really, and saying that the Americans reserved the rights to intervene in certain parts of the world. But the Malayan crisis, the Malayan emergency, was no doubt the big international event of these times in the early 1950s. The Malayan emergency is the official British government said for this situation in Malaya, whereas the rebels in Malaya called it the anti-British National Liberation War. Yes, it's a matter of opinion. This is the MNLA, who wanted independence from Britain. This was a guerrilla movement which fought for independence. And at this time, there were 35,000 British soldiers in Malaya, 35,000 British soldiers to try to defeat the rebellion. However, the rebellion was defeated. The British Army won. Of course, as you can imagine, the British Army had much better technology and much better guns than the rebels. But it was an interesting situation because the rebellion was defeated, but it became clear to the British that it was impossible to continue to be the colonial power at the other side of the world. First of all, it was too expensive. And so in 1953, plans were drawn up for the independence for this part of the world, which changed its name and became, if I hope I'm correct on this, Singapore. This is Singapore. Now, I think that Malaya was just part of what became Singapore, but I'm not absolutely sure. In any case, the Crown colonies in that region became independent in 1957. I'm not absolutely convinced exactly where Malaya is and where Singapore is, so don't take that too literally. My geography is not very good. So the Malayan emergency showed that it was possible for the British Army to defeat a guerrilla movement at the other side of the world, but that it was incredibly expensive, politically probably less and less popular. Perhaps the population were not too keen on this. I don't know. It was probably not massively unpopular, but it posed the question. So under pressure, the government announced plans for the independence of Malaya, Singapore, etc. And so this is the beginning of a realization, a very slow realization. People who run empires don't change their minds quickly. and the beginning of the end for the British Empire. And the next big moment, which I don't want to say too much about, is the Suez Crisis of 1956. In fact, I'm not going to talk about it because you're going to watch the video, two people are going to present the video, and then I will give a bit more on this. So let's suffice it to say that the Suez Crisis of 1956 makes it absolutely clear that the British Empire cannot continue as before, because it's very pragmatic situation, because it's too expensive. That's the up and down of it, okay? And of course, Britain's economy is in good shape, but from the point of view of the world, is absolutely not at all the size of the economy that can intervene everywhere in the world. The other element of international, politics is the question of nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons, in Britain, is in a very exceptional situation concerning nuclear weapons, a situation which it only really shares with France, because the big economies of the Western world, after America, France, Japan, Italy, Britain, Germany. Two of them were not allowed to develop nuclear weapons, Germany and Japan. That was part of the treaty, that they were not allowed to. And strangely enough, in fact, that became an advantage because Germany and Japan did not spend much, much less on military in the 50s and 60s, and so got the best technology, civilian technology in the world, and became very powerful economies. It's ironic. Whereas Britain decided, like France, we must have our own nuclear weapons. This was, of course, very controversial. In general, the position of much of the left was nuclear weapons cannot be used for progressive reasons. Many people on the left in Britain said, okay, sometimes wars are necessary. The armies which fought against Hitler were necessary. However, destroying cities by nuclear weapons can never help humanity, and so what we need, according to many people on the left, was a defense policy, a non-nuclear defense policy. That was not carried out, and one of the most impressive facts about the Labour government of 1945 is that they decided to secretly develop British nuclear weapons. The Americans had refused to share information about nuclear weapons with Britain. And the British government decided secretly to develop nuclear weapons. When I say secretly, there were six ministers who knew. Yeah. The other ministers were not told. It was a secret. And so it was 3 years later, a couple of years later, when it was announced that Britain was to have nuclear weapons. Although it has to be said, this did not cause a massive public outcry. And if the Labour government had been public about nuclear weapons, there probably would not have been a massive protest movement. Probably not. This caused all sorts of controversy. And debates, and I will come back to that in a moment. But Britain will be established in the idea that Britain needs nuclear weapons, and first of all, atomic bombs, testing atomic bombs on islands somewhere, and both the A bomb and the H bomb, the two kinds of atomic weapons. So this brings us with the question of why. Because the Labour government of 1945, in many ways, was very radical. Yeah, profit must not be the main question. We need the welfare state, etc. But on this question of nuclear weapons, they were very traditional. And I think also on the question of the empire, the Labour government was not very different from the Conservatives. Not very different. They were the Labour government of 1945 was certainly not anti-imperialist. Certainly not. This is a period in the 1950s then when Europe is organizing itself And you have the establishment of the European Coal and Steel Community. I'm not going to explain this in detail, but this is this is the very first stable structure of economic cooperation in Europe, which will slowly become the European Union, which we know today. Now, this is the first one. There's a European Coal and Steel Community. 10 years later, the European Economic Community. 20 years later, the European Union. And then 10 years ago, the European Union, which is much wider, with Czechoslovakia, Romania, Hungary, etc. So this is the period. Now, Churchill was not interested. When Churchill was Prime Minister, he was not interested. Should Britain join the European Coal and Steel Community? Churchill said no. No, we don't want to. And this, of course, is a general question for British foreign policy. What is the attitude to Europe? And Margaret Thatcher and David Cameron and other people have famous attitudes to Europe. What is the base of this? Fundamentally, the British economy, the people who run the British economy, have more choice than other countries in Europe. And certainly at this time, they had a choice. Shall we work mostly with Europe? Shall we work mostly with our colonies and ex-colonies? Or shall we work mostly with the English-speaking world and America? So a lot more choice. Europe was not absolutely obligatory. And that's still the case today, that France cannot imagine not working mostly with Europe. It's just all around it, yeah? Whereas Britain has more choice because of the language, because of the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth is the organisation of ex-colonies of Britain. So Britain has more choice. So it's not really, it's not just because the British hate the French. It's also for real economic reasons. Certainly, there are a lot of British people who don't like the French. Social change. To finish off the question of the 1950s, I want to look at social change. So, this is a time. Obvious. I mean, the National Health Service is a social change. As well, it's not just an institutional change, it's a social change. The rise in life expectancy is a social change, but I mean like people's everyday lives. A couple of statistics here to help you off. Television licenses. In 1956, there were 15,000 people who had a television license in Rue de Vos. In 1956, how many do you think in 1956? Ten years later? Anybody like to guess? Let me guess. Yeah? 50,000. Right, okay. I of course I do this deliberately. 5 million. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so absolute explosion. Now, this is 5 million in a population of 45 million. So even in 1956, say un télépôt 10 personnes. Which is probably about half the families. Yeah, so half the families have a television in 1956. So not everybody yet, but still obviously an absolute enormous explosion which will transform cinema. The number of people going to cinema. There are interesting things about this. Many people, probably most people, imagined that cinema would just disappear with the competition. And interestingly enough, cinema did not disappear. And also, radio did not disappear. Everybody imagined they would disappear. You know, why would you listen to the radio if you could watch the television? But in fact, it's more complicated than that, as we know. Another statistic for you. In 1949, 40 million people went to football matches. Football was absolutely massive Saturday entertainment. Through the 1950s, you also got, in 1954, the establishment of independent television. Before 1954, there was the BBC, that's all. The BBC was the only television channel. And in 1954, you get the establishment of private television. So we can see it's a conservative government, yeah? establishment of private television, ITV, and that has remained till today. There is public television and private television, but even today you have something very different from Britain and France, and that is the BBC today has no adverts. The public television in France has had no adverts permanently. The television invented new ways of entertaining people. The first television quizzes were in 1961. The very first television quizzes, there's one called Double Your Money. You know, Double Your Money. That's one of the more famous things. The 1950s are also the times when you get vacuum cleaners, washing machines, electric cookers. These are no longer luxury. Not everybody has one, but they're no longer luxuries. 1964, 52% of families have a washing machine. Now, washing machines are very boring, but the reason they're very boring is that we normally have one. If you don't have one, they're not boring anymore. And by 1964, we have 6 million cars. It's estimated that between 1952 and 1964, so 12 years, there is a rise of 45% in consumer spending. What is consumer spending? It's what you spend after you've paid the rents and the electricity, what you really have to go out and spend and buy things with. So a rise of 45%. Now, if you imagine how much money you have to spend on food, clothes, cinema, etc., if you have a rise of 45%, you would be pretty happy. Yeah, that's pretty. It's going to change the way you can do things. Now, the other important thing to remember here is that we know today that this was les Trente Glorieuses, et que en 64 ils en avaient déjà dépensé 20, il restait que 10. But of course, at the time, people didn't know this. People were convinced that unemployment was finished forever. That life was going to get better and better permanently, just all the way. Of course, it's a long time. Yeah, 20 years of boom. Nobody had ever seen 20 years of boom, so people were extremely optimistic. Of course, because it was just going to continue. And in fact, in 1956, a famous member of the, I think it was a member of the Labour Party, certainly very close to the Labour Party, he is said, "We stand on the threshold of mass abundance." That is, that very soon everybody will have everything they need. Of course, this is not the only side of the this is not the only side of the story, because from an economic point of view, certainly everybody's lives were getting better and better, and the age at which people became old changed very much. I mean, when I was young, my grandmother was 60 years old, and she was old. I mean, people were old when they were 60, and today you see people who are 60, and they really are not old. They really are not old. You think old is 30, I know, okay. But let's say that you're not surprised. I mean, when people were 60 in 1960, you expected them to sit at home and watch television and not want to do anything particular, and not want to go on a holiday abroad, and not want to read a new book, but just to sit around and wait to die, you know. And today that's absolutely not the case. But there's much more, of course, going on than this. And 1958 brought a shocking event, and this was the Notting Hill riots. What is going on in the boom is an important rise of the feu de présence, yes. An important rise of immigration. The 1945 and the 1951 government, they wanted a lot of workers. They wanted to rebuild, they had to rebuild London, half of it was bombed. They went to the British, some British colonies, especially the British colonies where people spoke English, and said, hey, come and work in Britain, it will be wonderful. And in particular, Jamaica, Trinidad, what we call the West Indies, les Antilles anglophones. On disait à l'époque les Antilles britanniques, mais c'est plus le cas, c'est les Antilles anglophones. They came to Britain in large numbers. We always talk about the Windrush. Now, the Windrush is a ship, and it arrived in Britain in 1948 full of workers from Jamaica. It's a symbol because it was the first ship to come with workers from Jamaica. Many of the workers, they thought, oh, well, I'm going to work here for a few years, make some money, and go home to my family. Of course, the whole thing about immigration is that going home is more complicated than you think. And very often, people don't go home, either because they don't have the money to go home, or because home has changed so much that it's not home anymore, or because they have changed so much that home isn't home anymore. It's an eternal situation. Now, the people who arrived, the Jamaicans who arrived in Britain, got a great shock, because they were not expecting racism. In Jamaica, well, everybody was black. In the school, they learnt Britain is a wonderful place who loves Jamaica, and the British Empire is wonderful. And so they really weren't expecting some very, very hard shock. Racism is horrible, but when you're not expecting it, it's even worse. It was very, 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 very frequent. You go to see in the newspapers, you have an advert, flat available, two bedrooms, no blacks, please. In the 1950s, this was completely legal. It was not illegal. It becomes illegal in a little in the 60s, sometime in the 60s. I'll tell you next week. Legally recognised and publicly defended racist discrimination. One of the results is that the people from the West Indies, they tended to live in the same parts of London, the only places that would accept them, and also the cheap places. And so you got a very big concentration. Was the situation when a very shocking event in August 1958, when there were attacks by white racists of black people, and also in particular of mixed couples. Black and white, man and woman together. This was something that racists hate more than anything. And so, important fights. This was not so unusual to be attacked by white racists. What was unusual in 1958 is that the local young black people organized and went and counterattacked. And so some of the gangs of white racists were taught back. And so for three days there were attacks on black people, and then for a few days there were attacks back on the racists. And it has to be said that at this time, when black people were attacked by white racists, the police really didn't care. Yeah. And that's not a very controversial opinion. I don't think anybody says the opposite. It's not, you know, it's this was a sit where they really didn't care. It has to be said that although there is still plenty of racism in Britain today, there is no doubt that the ordinary everyday racism has declined tremendously. When I was at school, you could hear racist jokes every day. Every day you could hear a racist joke. It was not so. You might like it or not like it, but it was very, very common. When I talk to my nieces and nephews who are teenagers in Britain today, they say, "Oh no, you might hear a racist joke every year, but not every day." Yeah. So certainly the situation has changed. Why has it changed? Difficult question. But in my opinion, the fact that in the 1950s white people didn't know any black people. So they were just this distant, scary thing. And today, most people work with some people who are white, some people are black, and you know, and very slowly, because racism disappears very slowly in people's heads, but very slowly, so, oh, well, I've been working with black people for 10 years, and maybe I should be a little bit less racist, you know. I'm not exaggerating, it really is very, very slow, but I think that's an important element. Okay, so final thing about the 1960s, now culture. Nice Lancashire pronunciation there, culture. In the south it's culture, in the south of England it's culture, but where I come from it's culture. So what are the writers and the literature which is influential at this time? Some of them have been forgotten. This writer, C.P. Snow, who wrote The Masters, these were influential novels at the time. Sorry, they're not novels, are they? No, they're collections of essays. The New Man, The Corridors of Power. This was an influential intellectual at the time. Probably more everybody has forgotten C.P. Snow today, in fact. Probably more long-term effect was from theatre. Theatre was very dynamic in the 1950s and seemed to begin to think about what can we do in the theatre which you can't do in the cinema. One of the best known ones has been adopted by, it's Irish, but has been adopted by the French, Samuel Beckett's. And it is in 1955 that he writes his book Waiting for Godot, which he himself translates into French as En attendant Godot. And Waiting for Godot transforms theatre. Because when you ask the questions, oh yeah, okay, so tell me about the story. Where does it happen? Oh, I don't know really. What happens? Well, nothing really. What period is it? Is it set in? Oh, I don't know. So it eliminates. So it eliminates society from the theatre. It eliminates time and it eliminates place. And one famous critic at the time said, "In Waiting for Godot, nothing happens twice." Yeah, because there are two acts here, deux actes. Rien ne se passe et puis rebelote. Okay, which is a little bit true. I don't know how well you know it. Qui connaît un peu cette pièce En attendant Godot? On le fait plus à l'école, deux ou trois personnes. On le fait plus à l'école, c'est ça? Okay. Yeah. I recommend it. It really is quite exciting. And very much about... So what's it about? Well, it's obviously about some sort of escape from society. So it's very existential. It's about, you know, what are waiting for Godot, waiting for God, yeah? Of course, there's a link there. Escaping into language or into, so something very psychological. And he continues with 1958, Endgame, 1962, Happy Days. And I think it's Happy Days where, so very, very innovative, very, very new. I think it's Happy Days where the heroine is buried up to her waist. Elle est enterrée jusqu'au là, et elle ne peut pas bouger. Elle peut simplement s'occuper de se maquiller et parler à son mari qui est également enterré jusque là. Okay, so very, very, very different. Yeah, obviously the being buried up to there is a fairly transparent metaphor for being blocked in your life in society and not free. So that's the idea. Yeah. So we're moving very much away from realism of any sorts. Harold Pinter is the other important playwright of this period, and he will write in 1958 The Birthday Party. And The Birthday Party, not like that. Not The Birthday Party. No, he didn't write that. No, that was somebody else. The Birthday Party, and in 1960 The Caretaker. But you also have some who are a little bit less known. This is still theatre. N.F. Simpson, A Resounding Tinkle. And N.F. Simpson resembles rather the French-Romanian playwright Ionescu. Maybe you know the plays Rhinoceros and Les Chaises and things like that. But you did have some writers trying to look at more realistic questions and social questions, and Brenda Behan in 1958 will write a piece called Borstal Boy. Borstal is a kind of school prison for young criminals, if you like. It doesn't exist anymore, but Borstal was, when I was young, that was, you know, that was where you went if you'd been very bad. Yeah, you were too young to go to prison. You went to Borstal. No, I never had that. Okay, so that's the theatre. In the novels side, we have Kingsley Amis, who was very influential at this time, and he wrote, for example, in 1953, Lucky Jim, which, if I remember correctly, is about a working class man who moves up in the world. And Alan Sillitoe, who wrote in 1958, Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. This is social realist novels. Yeah, this is what life is like up there. Which brings us to the end of the first two prime ministers, the Churchill and Eden. And I'm going to continue with Harold Macmillan.